Good morning and welcome to this June 25th, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and always available via podcast. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, we're here with authors to talk about craft, content, and the writing process. It's my pleasure to welcome this morning David James Poussant, and in the second half hour, novelist Emma Straub is here to chat about her novel, The Vacationers. David James Poussant's award-winning stories have appeared in The Atlantic, Playboy, One Story, The Southern Review, Glimmer Train, and in the anthologies New Stories from the South and Best New American Voices. He teaches in the MFA program at the University of Central Florida. His debut collection is The Heaven of Animals, published by Simon & Schuster, and what a fantastic collection it is. David James Poussant, welcome. I understand you go by Jamie, so we'll go by that. I'm going to first give you a chance to introduce the collection, talk about assembling it, where the stories came from, and some of your inspirations.
Well, I wrote them over a period of 8 or 9 years. I started, I think the earliest one was the story How to Help Your Husband Die, which is one of the odder stories in the book, the second-person story. That one didn't get published for a long time because I didn't have a lot of confidence in it. But I wrote these stories over a period of about 8 years, and I just wanted to explore relationships. I wanted to explore people, love the way that we try to love, and we could always love people better, and also wanted to explore the ways in which people aren't always so great at communicating, the ways we don't necessarily hear each other or we have trouble saying the things we mean. So there's a lot of realism in the collection, and then there's also some odd sort of magic realist pieces I threw in for fun.
Yeah, it was a good texture. You know, those short stories that kind of peppered throughout the collection. It was nice because they weren't all of the same texture. Kind of gave you a different perspective.
Yeah, that was actually my editor's idea. When I submitted the collection, there were 15 stories, and they were all of that equal length, that 20-page range, all the realist pieces. And she said, I want to see everything else you have, which I said, that's like another 25 stories. And she said, that's fine. And we read through all of them and just picked what we thought were my best, regardless of length, regardless of subject matter and voice. And so it, you know, became kind of a varied collection, but I think we like it that way.
But it works, yeah. It works so well. You know, one of the things that I've begun noticing in many effective short stories, and this collection was no exception in a lot of them, is that there are often two plots going on that are in conversation with each other, kind of the main forward action of a story and then some backstory that's kind of in dialogue with the present scene. Sometimes it seems wholly unrelated to it until you kind of step back and try and make sense of it. But has that become sort of an effective device for you? You know, I noticed it, I mean, certainly in Lizard Man, in Amputee, there's a lot of examples where there are kind of two plot lines that thread throughout each other. And I was wondering if that was sort of a conscious decision on your part or if that's just how stories kind of are structured in your head, or talk about that a little.
Sure. A couple of the after How to Help Your Husband Die, I wrote Venn Diagram and Lizard Man, and both those stories are doing what you're talking about, which is, starting in the present and then continually jumping back to the past, whether it's a year or a couple years, and a lot of characters are remembering something, and they're trying to atone for something, or they're regretting something, or trying to get over a grief, and I think that formula kind of worked for me for a while. I'm working on a novel now, and that's not the structure. I'm trying some new things, but for a while, yeah, that felt like a comfortable mode for me. Because, you know, I think we do spend a lot of our lives living in the past and thinking about things we've done. And so, I do see that a lot in contemporary short fiction.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing, you know, there are a lot of big, heavy themes in here, you know, loss of spouse, a loss of child, mental illness, infidelity. Like, if you could list all the really crappy things that could happen to your life, this is a really good start.
Yeah.
But they always manage to feel incredibly fresh. And, you know, you often hear when you're trying to publish something, oh, gosh, there's too many, you know, child death stories already out there. And, you know, but these are so new, such new takes on things. And I think that the devil kind of lies in the details. You know, I think that they feel so new, brand new and interesting because of the very particular way that you go into incredible detail. Do you kind of make a list of horrible tragedies and things that can happen to you?
No, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think I do write from a place of fear. I think, you know, rather than writing what I know, I tend to write what scares me. And so, I mean, I've been lucky in my life that, you know, I have a stable marriage. I haven't lost my children. I've been pretty lucky, all things considered, knock on wood. But as a result, you know, when the first terrible thing happens, it's going to be awful. So I think I'm constantly writing toward, okay, well, this is, how bad could it get? I think I also started off from kind of a place of blissful ignorance. When I first started writing, I wasn't aware of those rules of, you know, people will tell you, you can't write a story with a dead child, or you can't write a story with a dead dog. And I did both of those, like, right away. Not because I was trying to sort of brazenly go against the rules, but just because I didn't know that those were imposed. And the very first draft of Venn Diagram, it wasn't successful, and I talked to one of my fantastic writing teachers, Aurelie Sheehan at the University of Arizona, and one of the things she was saying is, you know, this is just, you know, a sad story. What can we thread through to make it more interesting? And that's when I started thinking about the animals, and what if Lisa is really interested in these nature documentaries, and what if, you know, I start bringing in these hippos and these alligators, and what could I do with that? And just trying to, yeah, like I guess you said, make them fresh. If I've done that, then I guess I feel like I've been successful.
Yeah, yeah. I think rules are there to be broken. And if you can break them successfully, you know, it all works, right?
I hope so.
So let's talk about the animals. It is organized around animals. And there isn't an animal in every single story, but most. And, you know, mostly for me, I just thought they were really great symbols and really great counterpoints to what the crazy humans in the story were doing. And, you know, I was wondering if you were thinking of animals as symbolism, or if your subconscious just sort of walked them onto the stage and then you said, well, that's interesting. You know, look at that bison who just walked in.
Yeah. I think when I first started writing the story, I had no idea I was doing it. It had to be pointed out to me after several years of writing stories that almost all of my stories had animals in them. And I think it's just because I really do love animals. I mean, I grew up with animals. As a kid, I had any animal you can think of. For ferrets, my mom never let me have a ferret, which is probably for the best because they really do smell pretty bad. But I just loved animals, and I loved writing them in the stories. And when I would get stuck in a story, I would just sort of march an animal out and see what happened. And so I think at some point I had this idea, well, I've got all these animal stories. I can organize a collection around it. And that was the initial idea. Some other great writers I really admire, Joel McCorkle, Hannah Tinti, they've done that with great effect. But then the editor and I stepped back and she said, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. You don't want it to become a gimmick. Let's just put the best stories in, whether they're an animal or not. And so that's what we did. And there's a lot of animals in there.
You know, it strikes me that your subconscious makes so many great decisions without you being aware of it. You know, that experience of writing something and then somebody else comes in and says, oh, did you notice this? And you say, no, I didn't. But obviously there's a lot going on in my head that I'm not even aware of that, you know, made it onto the page in a really interesting way.
Yeah, I don't think that's at all unique to me. I think, most writers will tell you that happens a lot to them.
Yeah. Right, right. Isn't it? It's sort of like working all your stuff out in dreams or something. Isn't it great when somebody else is doing the work for you while you're looking in another direction or something?
Sure. And the best writing, you know, when writing's going well and I'm sitting there, it does feel like dreaming. And I wish it felt like that all the time. And it just sort of, that voice takes over and you just sort of go with it.
Yeah, right, right. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are talking with Jamie Poussant. The book is The Heaven of Animals. It is out and available and fantastic. So you, sir, are the finder of the perfect metaphor for everything. I think you've brought up Venn diagram. You've brought up Venn diagram a couple of times this morning, and that is just a, you know, lovely metaphor. You've got, metaphors with poker. You've got, and I was wondering if you just sort of look at the world and see metaphor, or if this is another example of your subconscious sort of working things out for you, or if you take notes in the world and use them for later. But I hoped you could talk a little bit about your pitch perfect ear for this.
Oh, well, first, thank you. I'm not a notebook writer. I don't carry a little moleskin around and jot stuff down. But I do think a lot. I don't think that I'm going through the world looking for metaphors, but I love metaphor in fiction. John Updike was a big influence for me early on, and his work is chock full of metaphors and extended metaphors. And I think that what I do is when I'm writing, I stick metaphors in, and often they're the wrong metaphors. And I just think of them as placeholders. I think in the early drafts of throwing them in there. And when I come back, I take everything into account. Okay, what is the tone of the scene? What's the mood? Who is the speaker? What sort of metaphor would that speaker reach for? In fiction that I sometimes don't like, it's when the language is lyrical and there's lots of metaphor and figurative language, but it doesn't necessarily feel true to the life of the viewpoint character. So, I try to stick to how would that character see the world and what feels appropriate to his or her voice. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I guess kind of going along with that are titles. I think titles are really complicated, especially in short stories where they can't be spot on. They have to kind of be, playing against the story in some ways. And I hoped you could talk a little bit about that. It's harder for short story writers because they have to come up with, 15 titles instead of just one for the novel. So.
Yeah. Early on, I was bad at coming up with titles for my own stories. I almost never got to keep my original titles. They just weren't very interesting. I remember for Lizard Man, the original title was Signals, because there were a couple instances where, he's giving the boy the signal over his shoulder and he's looking for signals and there's a turn signal where he's trying to make a decision about where to go at the end of the story. What an uninspired title. And my friend Mika Taylor, who read the story, she was like, why don't you call the story Lizard Man? And I was like, that's much better every way. And so then as I got a little better at writing, got a little more experience, I became better at finding those titles that sort of seemed to encapsulate the whole story. But yeah, it's tough. And they change, and I go back and forth. Originally, the story about the man and the dog was called Me and James Dean. And then when it was published in Willow Springs, the editor and I decided to call it Between the Teeth. And then when it went back into the book, my book editor decided that Me and James Dean was better. So I like both the titles, but I could go either way. It's a weird thing, titling stories. If you open any story collection, you'll probably notice so many will say, originally appeared in this magazine as this title, and a bunch of the titles will be different.
Yeah, I had noticed that going through yours at the end, that a lot of the titles had switched back and forth. And I wonder do you have a sense now of when a title is good? I mean, I'd hear Signals and I'd say, yeah, that's not bad. And I wonder if that's also kind of the sort of pitch perfect ear of whether you have a sense of what's right do you know it when you hear it? Or
I think I do now, but I think it took 4 or 5 years to feel like I had that sense of, okay, this sounds right. This feels like it stands for the story and opens up the story in a way that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. The other hard thing, I think, for short story writers are endings, because unlike novels that kind of wrap up and you get a satisfying conclusion, short stories work better when you feel a little off kilter at the end and you leave the story going, I think I just saw a car accident in the rearview mirror, but I'm not quite sure what happened. And now we're too far past it to know. So talk a little bit about endings, knowing when you have the ending right, when it's time to end. If you often write too far and then have to, write too much and then you have to cut back the end to somewhere else, or how you know.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I think that there are a lot of stories of mine, including several that are in the collection, that sit in drawers for years while I just try to get the ending right. Because for me, whether it's my own story or someone else's story, my favorite part of the story is an ending. I feel like a great story that's been perfect throughout can be ruined by just an ending that leaves you feeling unfulfilled. So I try to work hard to get just the right ending. But that being said, what feels like a solid conclusion to me can feel open-ended to another reader. I just did a book club in Orlando a couple weeks ago, and the story that came up was Last of the Great Land Mammals. And one of the two narrators of that story does a sort of a crazy thing at the end, and half the book club had decided, oh, well, clearly she's going to die as a result of that, and the other half had decided, oh, she might just be hurt, but she'll be okay. And I was more in the, oh, she'll survive it camp. But I was shocked to realize, like, oh, once you release your story in the world, you don't get a say in how people interpret it. And so so half my readers are assuming, oh, she's dead, and that sort of made me sad, but I guess that's my own fault for not going on one more scene.
That brings up an interesting point about how literature is it's as much a dialogue with the reader as it is, or a conversation with the reader as much as it is, you know, a standalone piece. And you're right, once it's out there, the reader's going to put their own stuff into it, their own psychological stuff and their own point of view. And now it's a conversation. I think, you know, that's one of the great things about all literature, really, right?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's also talk about knowing the setting. And you've said in an interview that it's incredibly important for you to know the details of the setting, even though a lot of the experiences in the stories haven't happened to you. So knowing the setting and not the situation. And how you get to intimately know the places where the stories are set and the really particular details of the place, and then it allows you to imagine the rest. I think that's really interesting. I was hoping you could talk about that a bit.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, place is so important to me, and it doesn't even have to be a place that I know intimately. It just has to be, you know, sometimes it's just a place I've visited, and I think, you know, Big Bone Lick State Park, which is an actual place, and that's the setting of Last of the Great Land Mammals, I visited two or three times, maybe for an hour each time, before I started working on that story. I didn't take pictures or notes, but a place can really quickly just kind of get inside you. And once that happens, it just makes me want to set a story there. So even if I don't have a story in my head, even if I don't have a conflict or a conceit or characters, I will just throw a character into a setting that I've fallen in love with, whether it's San Francisco or a state park or, you know, Florida or Atlanta, and just see what happens. I mean, sometimes, like with Heaven of Animals, the sequel to Lizard Man, I intentionally decided, okay, I want to write this sequel to Lizard Man, and I know what's going to happen, and I want to set him off across the country. Hmm. But often, it just starts with the place. And even in that story, in Heaven of Animals, that drive that Dan makes is the drive that my wife and I made several times when we were visiting family in Georgia and then returning back to Tucson, Arizona, where we lived for 2 years.
Is that often the case where you don't know much of what's going to happen in a short story? You just let your characters go and kind of see where it goes and then revise from there?
Yeah, I rarely know. And as a result, it's not the most efficient process of writing. I have so many unfinished stories that just fizzled out because I didn't know where I was going. But when it does happen, it's a wonderful, happy accident. And I do like writing not knowing where I'm going, because I found that when I do figure out the plot pretty quickly, I lose momentum, I lose interest, I get bored with it. And I think if I'm bored, the reader would be able to tell in the prose that I was just writing toward an end that I already saw. So yeah, I like to try to save the surprise for myself as much as possible. Often what that means, though, too, is that in revision, I'll have this really interesting beginning, and I'll get a good ending, and then I'll have to kind of massage the middle and try to make the two link up so that the story makes a kind of fluid sense.
Right, right. What's the signal to you that it's not going to work out, that it's time to abandon it?
The signal for me is usually when I hit what feels like a middle, whether that's 5 pages or 25 pages, and there's just, and the end is still nowhere in sight, and I don't know what the characters want or where I'm going, and I just don't feel attached to their voices anymore.
Yeah.
Voices is really, really important to me. If I can't, you know, kind of hear that character's voice, then it's going to be tough to make myself go forward.
Right, right. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I am talking with Jamie Poussant. The book is Heaven of Animals. So many times in here, I found myself like literally saying out loud, or it was actually came out as screaming in my head. I'm like, oh God, no, don't, you know, don't say that to her. You can't say it. And, you know, more than once I closed the book mid-story to kind of take some emotional break. And I thought maybe this is a good rule for writers, that you force your characters to say things that you just can't say. Maybe you're thinking them, or sometimes they were even like too scary to even think for me. but, you know, things you want to say, things that you think, but that you don't often speak. And I was wondering if that was a conscious decision on your part to put dialogue in your characters' mouths that's scary, that's the kind of the thing you don't say, that's going to, you know, really mar this relationship between them. The dialogue is just fantastic. I wanted you to talk about that a little.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, well, thanks. I I think it goes back to that place of writing from what scares you. And I think that, you have to, or at least for me, I have to allow myself permission to write these really despicable people that can do some awful things and say some truly cruel things. But hopefully, at the end of the day, I want the majority of the characters to be redeemed by the story. But if not redeemed, I'm hoping that I'm writing from a place of empathy where the reader can see, you know, I love these characters, and I think they're human, and they're fallible, and they're deeply fallible, but they deserve some sort of grace or to be shown some mercy. And if I can get a reader to, you know, well, for example, Lizard Man, it's the story of a man who throws his gay son out of a window because he doesn't understand homosexuality and he can't accept it. And, you know, later he's trying to atone for that. And when I first started writing that story, I thought I would write it from the son's point of view. And I thought, how much harder would it be to write this story and get the reader to empathize with a man who actually threw his son out of a window, this, you know, hateful, homophobic man. I don't know how well I did it, but I like to try to take the more challenging route. And that often involves making the characters say these awful things and then thinking, you know, could the reader still ever care about this character? And I don't mean that so much in the sense of likability. There's a lot of talk about whether you like a character or not. And I think that readers of literary fiction are less concerned with liking characters than they are with relating to characters or seeing the world through a character's eyes, even if the character is capable of things that the reader would never do or condone.
Right. Right. Yeah. And all you treat all of these people with such a sense of compassion and empathy. And you're right. Most of the, or a lot of them, not most of them, but some of them are not the most likable people. But you always know what agency they're acting from. You always know why they're doing what they're doing. You know, they make psychological sense to me. And that's very relatable. Yeah, it's very relatable, I think, for the reader. So your latest work I read was is a novel that is spun out of the short story in this collection. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about when characters come back to you, how you know that these characters have legs, what appealed to you about these characters that spun this novel out of you.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, I often don't know. I think there were several years between the publication of Lizard Man and the writing of Heaven of Animals, and I just sort of get haunted by them again. With when I wrote Geometry of Despair, I didn't know that there would be Awake the Baby, the two that comprise Venn diagram. And when I wrote, a few years later, when I decided I wanted to finally write a novel, I wasn't sure what I was going to do, and I kept coming back to those characters of Richard and Lisa and thinking, wow, so, you know, they did have a son, Michael, and what happened then? And so I decided I would fly 30 years into the future and see what is life like now that Richard and Lisa are older, they're retirement age, they have two grandsons, and how did things work out for them? How did their marriage work out? Are they still grieving over the loss of their first child, June, who died as an infant? And then, you know, a novel just sort of became bigger and bigger in my mind until I had to write it.
It's funny you should say this because Emma Straub is going to be on in the second half, and her novel, which also is about a family who goes on vacation as adults, came out of a short story that from a collection of, you know, way back. You know, it's funny that I wonder if that's often the case, that short stories can be springboards for future novels.
That'd be nice, I think, right? They certainly can be. And then I think there are certain stories that just are just fine the way they are and shouldn't be forced into, you know, a larger form that not much could benefit by trying to. I had several people early on tell me, oh, you should adapt this man into a full-length novel. And something about that just didn't feel right. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but you have to go with, you know, with your cut.
Well, I think most short stories, you know, they are a short story for a reason, right? They encompass a period of time and a little world, and maybe they should just stay there frozen in amber the way they are. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they're not stories aren't like failed novels. They're their own form.
Right.
For sure.
Right, right. Before I let you go, I wanted to talk a little bit about MFA programs. You are a graduate of an MFA program. You teach in one. And I was wondering if that's, you know, sort of a recommended route for writers these days, what you got from it, and a little bit about your thoughts on MFAs.
Yeah, I mean, so there are going to be people who say they're terrible, don't do it, and people who say, oh, it's the only way. I mean, I don't think it's the only way. There's this whole debate now going on about MFA versus NYC and whether you're better off just living in New York City. I love New York City, but I couldn't right now at this point in my life imagine being there, and I love the South and love being there with my family. So an MFA seemed like the way to go for me, and so many lawyers have gotten them, you know, going back to Flannery O'Connor, and she did fine. I think that the best thing to do is to cast a super wide net and know where you're applying, know who the faculty is, know the cultures of the program, and then decide, do I want to go to a program that I'm going to have to pay for? Do I want to wait until I get into a program that gives me a free ride? Because the majority of programs now pay you to go. And if you can get, you know, $10,000, $20,000 a year, right, for 2 years, that 2 years is a gift where you can produce more than you could possibly produce on your own with a full-time job. I think of it not so much as what you're getting isn't just the benefit of instruction, because you can take that or leave that depending on who you are. It's the gift of time to say, for the next 2 or 3 years of my life, I'm going to put writing at the center of my life. And there's not many times in your life when you get to do that. You know, once you have a job, it gets harder and harder to make the time. But as a student, you have nothing but time, and that's where you can really let your creative process flourish and just learn how you work and who you are and how you write.
Exactly. Right. Right. Is there any writing advice that we haven't covered that you're aching to get out to aspiring or established writers?
Oh yeah. Read. That's my writing advice, is to read. I have some students who are wonderful writers, but they don't read a lot. And so a lot of their writing stays sort of one voice or one mode. And I think the more you read, not just, you know, the more ideas you'll get for storylines, but you learn, and writing is a bunch of tricks. It's tricks, and you have a toolbox, and you see how this writer does a metaphor, and this writer does imagery, and this writer does point of view. And you don't, or rarely, you know, are you encouraged to straight out copy and borrow. But somehow you begin to intuit it all and learn from osmosis. And the more widely you read, even forcing yourself to read things you don't think you're going to like, the more widely you begin to digest all this stuff, the more it'll rub off on you, and the more you'll be capable of doing varied and interesting things in your own work.
Fantastic. Fantastic advice. So we find you online. You have a website.
Yes. Yep. DavidJamesPoissant.com.
Perfect. And I know you're on Facebook, because I liked you yesterday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Are you doing book tours and for this short story? Do you come to the West Coast at all?
I was in Seattle and Portland. I haven't been to California yet, just waiting for someone to invite me out there. Throughout the fall, I'm going to be going around to the South and doing the Summer Festival of Books and the Decatur Festival of Books, and then hitting some universities and bookstores all through Kentucky and Tennessee and Carolina. And that'll all be up on the website soon.
Fantastic. We'll follow you there. David James Poissant, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you, Marie. I appreciate it.
Too. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Novelist Emma Straub will be joining me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows we've done, what's coming up. She does a speaker series event. There's a lot on that website. I recommend you check us out. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Emma Straub. Emma is from New York City. She is the author of the novels The Vacationers and Laura Lamont's Life in Pictures, and the short story collection Other People We Married. Her fiction and nonfiction have been published in Vogue, New York Magazine, Tin House, The New York Times, Good Housekeeping, and the Paris Review Daily. She's a staff writer for Rookie. The Vacationers is out from Riverhead Books, and it's what we'll chat about this morning. Emma, hi.
Hi. Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So I'm going to give you a chance to introduce the novel, talk about The Vacationers. I understand it's spun out of a short story, so maybe you can talk a little bit about that. We were just talking in the first half hour with Jamie Poussant about how his novel In Progress also is spinning out of a short story. So talk a little bit about The Vacationers and where it came from.
Sure. So I wish I could say that The Vacationers came out of a short story, but in fact, there are three short stories in Other People We Married about these characters, but those stories actually came out of a failed novel. So it's a case of a failed novel into short stories into a novel.
I like that. That's great.
Yeah. But so The Vacationers is about an American family from New York City on vacation in Mallorca, Spain, for 2 weeks. It's a couple, Jim and Franny Post, who have been married for 35 years. Their 18-year-old daughter, Sylvia, who has just graduated from high school, her 28-year-old older brother, Bobby, and his much older girlfriend, and then their two, Franny's best friend, a painter named Charles, and his husband. And they're all sort of trapped in this beautiful house together for 2 weeks, and lots of things happen.
I have to say, I read this novel while I was on vacation with my family, with my dad. And it's a good novel, you know, now that summer is kicking off. It's a fantastic novel to take on your family vacation, especially if your family is not just like your husband, but your actual extended family.
Right, yes.
To remind yourself that we all have this, right? We all have crazy.
And... Oh, we sure do. Yeah, I think, you know, I feel very lucky because I'm very, very close with my parents. And my family is, I would say, far less complicated than the Post in terms of our interpersonal relationships. But yeah, but everyone's family is complicated and messy in you know their own unique ways. And I had a lot of fun with this family because you know even though there are certainly problems and issues arise, there's also a lot of humor I think when traveling with your family because there are you know, things that people know about you because they've known you for your entire life, and so there's this sort of long history inside every individual relationship, which was really fun for me to explore.
That they'll never let you forget, right?
Absolutely.
That will haunt you until you're dead. Speaking of family, so your father is a novelist as well, and it's I thought that could be a funny dynamic of having, you know, two novelists in the family who, you know, can take up with each other on paper as well as they can in person.
Yeah, it's true. I think, you know, luckily my father and I write very, very different sorts of things. He, you know, my father, writer Peter Straub, and he's written about 20 novels, and they are all pretty deep, dark, scary affairs with, you know, murder and torture and all that kind of thing. and the worst thing in terms of violence that happens in my book is that someone ends up with a black eye. So
That
I think tells you the difference.
That tells you everything you need to know, right?
Yeah.
So I'm interested in this. I love the idea that you wrote a novel that was a, you know, I don't think anything's a failure of writing, but it wasn't published, but yet you were able to mine material out of it for all kinds of things. A lot of stuff came out of it. So it's a good message for writers that, you know, nothing is lost, really.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I wrote three novels in my early 20s before I got anything published, before I'd published so much as a short story. And then this novel, the novel that I sort of pilfered the stories about the Post from, really, in many ways, was the first draft for The Vacationers, only it was, you know, called something else and entirely different. but it was the same characters and it was the same conflict, really. Only it was a disaster because I hadn't really figured out what I wanted to do with them yet.
So
it took me a number of years to figure out exactly what I wanted to do with these people. And once I figured out that I wanted to take them on vacation, and I wanted to get them out of their comfort zones, then it all came together really quickly. So depending on how you calculate it, it either took me about 7 years to write this book or about 4 months.
I like the latter, but yeah, right. Yeah. You know, it strikes me as really smart to have seven kind of major-ish characters, seven, you know, point of view-ish characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then the combinations of putting them in rooms together yield so many different things. When you have that many people on stage that you care about, and then you can do all kinds of combinations that, you know, these two people go off together, and it yields a lot of unexpected, maybe, plot points. So how plotted was it? Did you have that in mind that I'm just going to send these two characters off together and we'll see what happens? Or did you kind of know what was going to happen and used it as a device to get it to happen?
I had it. I had the major story arcs plotted out. So I, you know, for example, I knew what I wanted to have happen with Charles and his husband. I knew what I wanted to have happen with Sylvia and with Jim and Franny, but I didn't plot out the sort of smaller day by day plot. So it was sort of both. Like I knew where I wanted, where I thought at least where I wanted them to get, but I also had the fun of just sort of setting them loose and saying, okay, well, what would I do if I was on vacation in Mallorca and I'd been there for 3 days and I was feeling sort of trapped and mad at my husband? Would I maybe drag this teenage girl along with me to a museum? You know, I had fun sort of planning their vacation on the fly the way anyone would on vacation.
Yeah. Now, what does your physical office look like? Like, do you have charts for these seven people? Because you have to arc, you know, each character's journey, and you'd have to arc the relationship journey.
Well, so when I was writing this book, I was also pregnant, and so I always write sort of reclining, but things got really, really luxurious, and it was like I was always writing sort of with, like, you know, lots of, like, a gallon of water and a bucket of ice cream, like, at all times, basically. And so I wish I could say I had charts, but there wasn't room. There wasn't room for the charts in my workspace, plus my expanding belly day by day by day.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I had a few documents on my computer, but really I just tried to sort of keep it all in mind as much as possible, which sounds hard, but by the time I was writing this, I really did know these characters so well that it wasn't that tricky for me to sort of just to know where they were. I mean, I did have to sort of, you know, scroll back and say, oh shit, you know, where was this character the last time I saw them? Oh, I need to, you know, I did have to do some, like, little housekeeping things as I went, but yeah, it was pretty easy to keep them all in mind. They're staying in a pretty small house, so there weren't that many options.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. Was there anything that surprised you about these characters? Did they do anything unexpected that sent it off in a, well, they couldn't have sent you too far off because you did it in 4 months, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there were, I mean, one of the things that happens sort of before the book opens is that Jim has cheated on his wife with this much younger woman in his office, and I thought I knew sort of how Franny was going to respond, but I didn't really know how Jim felt about it. Like I think we often, you know, in books and films and TV shows, we often see, you know, that sort of cheating from the person who's been wronged, you know, from their point of view. But I hadn't really thought about it from Jim's point of view.
Mm.
And so his thoughts on that situation surprised me quite a bit. And then, you know, there were sort of more fun things too, like Sylvia, who's the 18-year-old daughter. She has the hots for her Spanish tutor, and I wasn't exactly sure where that was going to go, but I was very happy for her.
I was,
at the end of the book, I'll say that.
I was, too.
Oh, good.
We're all happy for her.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was funny when I read that you write for Rookie, which I wasn't familiar with Rookie until I started exploring it. And having a teenage daughter, I think I'll put her onto it.
Oh, but, please do.
Yeah. it struck me that that's a really great platform for, I don't know, for revisiting teenage angst, but there was, you know, a fair amount of teenage angst in the novel. And, you know, I was wondering how much in dialogue your writing for Rookie came into play in the novel.
So for the people who are listening who aren't teenage girls or who don't
know
any teenage girls might not be familiar, Rookie is an online magazine edited by Tavi Gevinson, who is now 18, and it is a website for teenage girls, for the most brilliant teenage girls on the planet, really. And I've been writing for it since the beginning, which is, I guess, about 3 years now, three or so years. And it is just so much fun. There are a number of teenage girls who write for the website and who take photographs and design things and draw. And then there are also a number of, you know, old people like me. I'm 34, so in Rookie world, I'm like 100. But it's really been great for me in terms of, you know, staying in touch with actual teenage people. Because, you know, I feel very in touch with my sort of high school self, but now that was, you know, 15 years ago. So it's really nice to sort of feel like I'm still aware of what teenagers are like. And lo and behold, they're still suffering about the exact same things that we were.
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, their emotional landscape obviously is exactly the same. You know, human nature doesn't change.
Yeah.
But their issues are so different. You know, she's grappling with all these photos being on the internet. And,
oh, God.
You know, thank God that didn't exist when I was a teenager. But
me too. Yeah.
You know, yeah, I mean, their their issues are the same, but their platform is different or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's true. I'm so glad that Facebook did not exist when I was a teenage girl.
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely.
I thank my lucky stars.
Absolutely. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Emma Straub, and the book is The Vacationers. So can you read to us for just a minute, and
sure.
Then our listeners will know even more of what we're talking about this morning.
Sure. Okay, so the section that I'm going to read, just a couple of pages here, is from Franny's point of view. It's just after they've gotten to Mallorca, and she's her daughter and her husband are sleeping. They've got jet lag, and she is going to set out and do a little grocery shopping. They would drive to a larger supermarket later, maybe tomorrow, but for now all they needed were a few things to make for dinner. Franny was the mom, which meant that all the planning fell to her, even if anyone else had been awake. No matter that Jim no longer had a job. Some retirees took up cooking as a hobby, turning their kitchens into miniature cordon bleus, filling drawers with brulee torches and abandoned parts of ice cream makers, but Franny couldn't quite imagine that happening. Most retirees had chosen to leave their jobs after decades of service and repetitive stress disorders, and that wasn't what had happened to Jim. What had happened to Jim? Franny kicked a loose rock. They'd always enjoyed vacations, the posts, and this seemed like as good send-off as any, complete with days at the beach and views to kill. Franny wished she had something to break. She bent over to pick up a stick and flung it over the cliff. The road to the small town, really just an intersection with a few restaurants and shops on either side, was narrow as they'd noticed driving up the mountain, but walking along the side of the road, Franny felt as though it had shrunk even further. There was hardly room enough for a fleet of bicycles to whiz by her, let alone a car or, God forbid, two going in opposite directions, but whiz they did. Franny was not a tall woman, but she wasn't as short as her mother and sister. She liked to think of herself as average size, though the averages had, of course, changed over time, Marilyn Monroe's size 12 being something like a modern size 6, and so on. Yes, it was true that Franny had gotten thicker in the last decade, but that was what happened unless you were a high-functioning psychotic, and she had other things to think about. Franny knew plenty of women who had chosen to prioritize the eternal youth of their bodies, and they were all miserable creatures, their taut triceps unable to conceal their dissatisfaction with their empty stomachs and unfulfilling lives. Franny liked to eat and to feed people, and she wasn't embarrassed that her body displayed such proclivities. She'd gone to one horrible Overeaters Anonymous meeting in her early 40s, in a stuffy room in the basement of a church, and the degree to which she recognized herself and the other men and women sitting on the folding chairs had scared her away for good. It might be a problem, but it was her problem, thank you very much. Some people smoked crack in alleyways. Franny ate chocolate. On the scale of things, it seemed entirely reasonable.
That was Emma Straub reading from her novel, The Vacationers. So great. Let's talk a minute about it being set in Mallorca, because that's, you know, it strikes me as really the perfect setting. You've got this island that feels very claustrophobic. There's only so far away from these people you can geographically get if you needed to. You're surrounded by water, which proves dangerous. Once somebody steps into the water, it goes a little slightly bad. And you know, and it's foreign, but it's beautiful. It's all of these contradictions, and it just struck me as the perfect setting. So talk a little bit about choosing that spot, getting to know it, whatever research you had to do to bring it to life so beautifully.
So I knew that I wanted to send them to an island because that seemed metaphorically sound in terms of the experience that I wanted to create for them. You know, I wanted them stuck with only each other out in the middle of an ocean, or, you know, I wanted them floating in space, basically. And Franny is a food writer and a travel writer, and so I knew that she wouldn't be content going somewhere that felt really well-trodden for American travelers. You know, like, for example, she wouldn't want to go to Puerto Rico, but she might go to Vieques. Or, like, you know, she wouldn't want to go to the Caribbean because there were too many cruise ships, that sort of thing. And so I was looking at maps and thinking about various options. And my mother then went to Mallorca to visit friends of hers who lived there. And I started doing some reading about it, and it just seemed really perfect because there's great food. It's physically very dramatic and beautiful. There are, you know, sort of craggy looking mountains and beautiful beaches, you know, windy, slightly dangerous roads, all things that really sort of fit in with how I was imagining the story. And then, my husband and I went for 2 weeks this winter in January and February, and we had such a lovely time because it was the off-season, and so the island was sort of ours. We spent a little time in Palma, which is the biggest city on the island, and then we spent a little time up in the country in a town where I ended up setting their house. And it was great. We stayed at this beautiful hotel that was made affordable to us by virtue of it being the off season, and we were sort of the only people there. And it was just magic. It's a gorgeous place. I highly recommend Mallorca to everyone.
You're killing me here. That's great. So once you were there, did it really speak to you and say, "Yeah, you're right. This is where this novel needs to be."
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because you know there's a literary history there. You know, George Sand and Chopin lived there, and she wrote this book called Winter in Mallorca that was hilarious to me because it was all about how horrible Mallorca was. So I read that, and Robert Graves lived there. There's a Robert Graves museum that we went to, and he loved Mallorca, and it was, you know, phenomenally gorgeous where he was. But yeah, I mean, there was a sort of a rich literary history, and there are lots of artists on Mallorca, and I just loved it, and I thought yes, the food is so good. There's wine, there are beaches, there's swimming pools.
Isn't it nice when the universe just says, you know, yeah? Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's so nice when the universe points you to the right spot and says, yeah, you know, all arrows point here. And
absolutely, I mean, especially because I was you know, about 3 months pregnant by that point, but when we went, and so if it had been all wrong, then I don't know what I would have done. So I really needed it to work, and it did.
Thank God. We're drawing down on our time, but I was wondering if there was any other writing advice or wisdom that you give out to either aspiring writers or even established writers. What has served you well?
Well, I guess for for aspiring writers, I would say that it's really, really healthy and good to get rejected as much as humanly possible. I mentioned earlier that I wrote these three novels before I published anything that got rejected by hundreds of editors. And all it means now is that I don't care when I get rejected. I still get rejected all the time, and it doesn't bother me in the slightest. So I would say send your work out widely, and don't be afraid, because what's the worst thing that could happen? Someone says no, who cares, you know?
Good point. Excellent, yeah. Excellent point. Emma Straub, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you for talking to me.
That was Emma Straub. The book is The Vacationers. It's out from Riverhead Books, and it is a fantastic summer read. That's all the time we have for today. I will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Lisa C. will be joining me then. So until next time, thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.